Hey creatives, you're listening to The Truth is Golden, a podcast produced by Revelator Studio and hosted by yours truly. My name is Arno, welcome to this episode. It is a show about creative minds, what makes them tick, their successes, failures, and everything in between. It is for people who are interested to learn more about creativity and its potential to make the world a better place.
So today I have the pleasure to count Sasha Radulovic, Johanna Hurme, and Colin Neufeld as our distinguished guests. They are architects, partners at 5468796 Architecture, one of the most creative and promising architecture firms in Canada, based out of Winnipeg.
Follow us on our website at rvltr.studio.
Thanks to all three of you for being on the show. It's a real treat to have you.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
Can you tell us who you are and what you do?
Well, I think if I'm speaking of all three of us, we're former classmates. We all went to school together at the University of Manitoba. And interestingly enough, Colin's the only one who's originally from Winnipeg. And so he's our sort of local anchor. And I came over to Canada as an exchange student in high school. That's how I got to Manitoba. And then Sasha is a refugee from the Yugoslav War in the mid-90s. And we all ended up at the University of Manitoba in the architecture program as a result of those circumstances.
You're architects.
Right.
How did you all three end up in this field?
My dad was an architect, so I think from the age of four, there was nothing else I wanted to do, and that never changed. Now I'm rethinking it, but the... It never changed going through the education.
Cool. Yeah, in the effort of being boring, my dad was also in the business, and so it just seemed like the thing to do. I would say that he was on the more technical construction side of things, and as I was exposed to maybe the more creative side of architecture, it just fell in love with it and felt like the place to be.
Yeah, I don't have any architects in my family. Most of them are engineers, my aunts and uncles, and then my parents are more like accountants and managers, and so I found that incredibly boring. And maybe as a reaction, I always knew I wanted to be in the creative field, but the real push for me was when I was around 12. I was reading the newspaper, and there was always some sort of an article about architecture, and that kind of happened to be peak competition in Hong Kong, so there was Rahadid's entry to the competition, and somehow the way that it sort of pulled off the mountainside, or I thought I got what architecture was about in that moment, and I thought it was somehow, you know, relevant to the context, and it sort of played off of it, and it seemed amazing, and I thought, for sure, you know, she can do it, sure can I.
So you guys said you were classmates in university. How, or at what point did 5468796, yes, I did it, come about? Was it something that was a long time in the making, or can you tell us a little bit about that story?
You know what, in the making for about a year, maybe two. I don't think any one of us ever thought that we're not going to do something of that kind, meaning that we would actually run it. We just didn't know what form and shape. I always thought I wouldn't be ready until I'm 45. I think that we would be able to do that, but we started out of turning 35, so we or 34. So, and we didn't know what format or what form it would take. And because we sort of all liked each other in school, both the seriousness as well as sort of wit and approach to life. And then just happened after about a year of intensive thinking about it. So the triggers were, we were starting to figure out how to get work. We were starting to be treated as sort of partners by the outside world, but not our past company. So that was sort of one of the triggered departure, if you wish, which was a new beginning, of course, of 5468. That's the boring answer. I guess the more interesting answer is we're trying to make a difference, to do something that you're not seeing enough of on these territories. And we were told at the time, this is an often told anecdote, we were told at a time that we as architects should not be discussing concepts or design with our clients, because there is no room for that in the profession, if you wish, or in the market. We were hoping they were wrong, and we were hoping we were right. And so we thought, when started, we thought that the one of the best things we can do is test that. And if it doesn't work out, we'll still be employable in a year. Today, we are completely unemployable, but the 11 years ago, I think we could have found a job and gone back to a regular workforce, I guess.
So you touched a little bit on what you do differently or what makes you unique. I would like one of you or several of you guys to tell me a little more about what makes the firm unique and whether that was something you consciously started doing when you started the business or if it's something that came about later on.
It's always tough to make a claim that you're doing something unique or even to be sort of aware of what the origins of that might be. I think the one thing that we've now, looking back on sort of the decade of history that we have behind us, that we've noticed, at least in our context, that some of the things that color our projects differently are sort of this attention to the space that falls between buildings. So that's one thing. And the other is this sort of, I think, hunger or desire that's built in, that, you know, we get this pit in our stomachs and sort of feel occasionally that, well, we're not doing enough and what else is out there. So there's this constant search for trying to challenge the norm and trying to do something that would break new ground in the, let's say, the architectural typology that we're working on, whether it's housing or some other project type, and try to discover that what hasn't been tested yet or what hasn't been tried.
Canada, in my opinion, at least, Canada is a very conservative place when it comes to design architecture. I don't think there's a lot of people who truly try to think outside the box. I actually had this conversation with a friend this morning. So how do you maintain that ability to do that while at the same time fulfilling your clients' expectations and briefs and the rest of it?
Well, I just add to that, the one thing that I didn't mention is maybe the context is something that we have definitely been sort of a product of our context, and the conservatism that you talked about was very, very prevalent in when we started, and it was more sort of jarring at that time, even more so than today, that there was very little sort of new territory that was looked at in architecture in our city, it felt like anyway. And lots of our peers fled to greener pastures, different cities and so on. And somehow that quick feedback loop that we had around us, where we could hear quickly if somebody was upset with the work that we were doing or if they really loved it, that quick feedback loop really taught us a lot of things. Also taught us to be very frugal when it comes to throwing out design ideas and always testing them and seeing if they were actually essential to the project, and throw out everything that seems frivolous to the idea and the core of the pursuit.
There's something about not designing. They're not just design ideas. They're like project ideas or a way to redefine the project for the client. Like I think your question was also about what, like, how do you meet the client's pro forma and how do you meet their budgets and business plans and all that kind of stuff? And I think it's important to say that we always, we treat those as givens and things that maybe even we look to exceed or add to or surprise them with ways to maybe expand even beyond what they thought was possible, not just from a creative design approach, but in terms of aesthetics or daring forms or what have you, but even from a project makeup, that ultimately often results in the architecture of the project, or at least leads to it, so that if the project gets defined beyond what they came to us with, then there's more of an opportunity than just trying to add architecture to something.
You've been in practice for 10 plus years in Winnipeg. Has there been any changes in the industry or in the field in that particular market or elsewhere? And what would those changes be?
I think there's generally more optimism in the field. There's certainly something that we observed earlier on, and we've said this a lot, but that architecture wasn't really in the cultural radar 15 years ago. And there's been efforts, you know, by us, by many of our colleagues too, to try to bring it back as part of the broader definition of culture through different, you know, shoestring projects or public engagement projects and events and things like that. And now there's more of a dialogue about what design is and what it should be or what it could be. And so that certainly gives us hope.
How do you envision the future of architecture in Canada and
possibly even in the Winnipeg area?
That's a big question. Yeah, I'm not convinced that anything is going to change. On the other hand, I always hope things are just going to change and improve. I always think of Johanna. You often speak about Alvar Aalto being on your banknote, and that being definition of how a culture or how a country sort of reflects its feeling about architecture and so on. And I think we're very far in Canada from getting Arc'teryx or anybody on our banknote. We did get a building recently, a modern building recently on a banknote. I do think that I think the harder the context, the actually better it is for us to just prove our worth. So I'm not sure I'm so down on the idea of architecture being, or the milieu being conservative. But I think that sort of allows us to be more innovative. It forces us to think harder or to work harder. And I think that's what architecture should do.
I think it's interesting that your question is sort of, where do you think architecture is heading? But also, so that's like the industry and architects, us as creators of that architecture. And then your comment, Sasha, lends me to think, where do you think the culture of architecture or the respect or the place of architecture lands in Canada's sort of consciousness or whatever? And I don't know the answer to that. Like, I think, yeah, we can be optimistic that that's going to change dramatically. But I think the more dramatic changes have happened and are going to happen within the practice of architecture. And there is a complete shift towards sort of optimism and creativity and sort of experimentation and small practices, and all of that has really had quite a renaissance or quite a renewal in the last decade or two decades. And I would believe and hope that that is going to continue. And I think that sets up the right sort of place to practice from, regardless of where the culture of how that gets embraced by the country or the predominant culture, if architecture culture.
Yeah, but
culture...
also I think that it's not something that's just sort of changing because we got lucky. I think it's changing because, you know, architects need to be more embedded into further or wider spectrum of society. Like, we have to be actors in sort of key places. And I sort of often preach about this to whomever will listen, but it's like, you have to be within the business world. You have to be within the political realm. You have to talk to city builders and makers about the values that are intrinsic to our profession, and we'll make the world better in some small increment if we can find enough people to listen. But it's somehow we've talked about this a lot recently, where we think the architect's role is much more of a strategic role than just sort of designing buildings and putting that into a box. But so it's trying to carve out opportunities for architecture to exist, more so than doing it when it falls on your lap.
So from what I hear and the research I've done in preparation for this interview, it seems like you guys have, for maybe lack of a better term, a very pragmatic approach to practicing architecture, even though you may allow yourself to be thinking outside the box and being creative. Does that ring true? And if yes, how does that? How do you reconcile the two, being pragmatic on one hand and being more creative and free thinking on the other?
You know what? I think the question we often ask ourselves as we think of ourselves as pragmatic architects is, especially when we see designs that are On the first ball or the first look, rather innovative, if you wish, or formally experimental and so on. We often ask ourselves, is any of that complexity actually helping the experience, and could it be recreated with less expression? You know, and the answer is often, yes, it could be. And finding the piece of plywood, when you talk about pragmatism, a piece of plywood comes angular, right? And while it can be modified and changed and so on, it is rather difficult. So the question that we ask ourselves, could we create an emotion by not overcomplicating it? And I think that's the pursuit that one of the pursuits that we're interested in. So the pragmatism comes more of that way rather than understanding nuts and bolts, which we still do. And I think any architect has to do that. But it comes in questioning and I think, Johanna, you were instrumental in instilling that feeling or sense as we go through it. Is it any better? That question is always front and center when we're going through design. Isn't any better if it has frills and gimmicks and formal gymnastics, etc., etc.?
I think the other layer of the practice in pragmatism is is the fact that we tend to sort of follow where the project leads us. That's sort of what we would call being the hyper-rational about it. And we always have some sort of set of parameters and limitations that come with the project, you know, whether it's context related or whether it's budget related or programmatic or whatever it may be. There are cues in there that lead us to places that we never really start with the aesthetic ambition or even the architectural ambition. We start with, let's look at the pieces that we have available and how, you know, solving one issue or responding to an issue leads to another discovery. And that's sort of the logic being sort of, I guess, driven by those parameters is what often leads us to solutions and then inspires something that, you know, you can still operate within the limitations and be creating something that's more interesting. But I think that's the other sense of the cognitive.
I know you don't want all three of us to answer every question, but there's something about pragmatism, I think, and this assumption that it's inherently boring. I think we try to combat that. Doing things that make sense and finding things that are right and true about a project do not have to make it inherently boring or dumb or whatever word you want to attach to it. We actually think that's what unlocks creativity, and being pragmatic can be fundamentally creative.
A friend of mine who was a past guest on the podcast, Dan Baroon from Los Angeles, was talking about that when I did the interview. He was saying how he constantly has to edit his designs down to the essence to only keep the most important part that will create the experience. He's looking for how much editing yourselves do you guys do?
That is a constant effort. I think it's oftentimes the process is such that we'll sketch something up and look at it and sort of each other, you know, is this something or does it feel inspiring? And then we try to call the BS from it. We try to say, you know, are these parts necessary? And, you know, going through the process of asking, like, so what? Or why would we do that? And what does that add to the equation is really sort of fundamental, I think, to how we approach things, whether we're cognizant of it or not.
So what would be a cue for you that in that editing process you've achieved what you wanted to achieve and it's you've kind of reached the essence of the idea you were looking for? And how do you know when to stop?
Well, we try to talk through it before we ever put a pen on paper. And I think the more we do that, usually the more satisfied we are with the result. Arguably, they get better. We think, and that's part and parcel of the process. When do you stop? I think maybe that's one of the other things that we struggle with. We never want to. However, it's always about sort of sharpening the pencil. You always can sharpen it a little bit better than the previous time. So you work within the constraints of any given project, time and budget.
And that's also one of the strengths, right? That we don't stop with the process. Like we often, to the frustration of ourselves and maybe sometimes the schedules on projects, like we keep trying to pursue design ideas until the drawing set is supposed to be 100% complete. And then sometimes even on site, still seeing things, how they could be better or how they could be edited down. Yeah, I don't know if we'll ever get to the point where there's a clear cutoff point that now the design is done. It's usually not done until the construction is done.
No, and there's sort of an editing from both sides. There's an editing of ourselves and the design intention, etc. And then there's almost like a pursuit and a adding of design back, because there's so many things that fight against design during construction, during design, during construction drawings, etc., that you're also pursuing relentlessly, I think, the keeping the design and keeping the intention. So it's you're editing it from both ends, if that makes sense, not trying to lose the essence, but also not trying to add the sort of extra to the essence of it. And so I think there's enough sort of almost built into the process of it that as long as you keep pursuing it, I don't know, I think that's what we find. You just, as long as you keep pursuing those things that you wrote down or that you discussed or that got you excited at the beginning, it edits itself. We have to edit the design and then the process sort of does that for you on the other side.
I'd like to stop talking about work for a minute and go back in time. Can you tell us what you guys were like as kids?
Awesome.
That's an awesome question. Well, I have a whole bunch of children at home. I got four kids at home that remind me of myself. Probably I don't have to remember that far back. I have a 9-year-old son that climbs everything, is constantly sort of pulling things apart and putting them back together and questioning, and just has this sort of outlook on life that reminds me, I think, a lot of myself, but maybe I want to see myself in him too. I don't know. But there was a curiosity that was sort of insatiable, I know, for a large part of my childhood.
I was bossy. I was super, telling my group of friends that they should play and how they should do it. I don't know. What shirt?
You're bossy.
Sounds like a horrible quality, but I'm just going to admit to that. Yeah, and then I was very much like sort of, introvert, but I would often create things and sew my own clothes or like that questionable fashion sense, certainly, at one period of time there. I don't know what else to add to that. Weird to talk about yourself as a child. I don't know that I would know necessarily. I was sensitive.
Sasha had no childhood, so we don't know if Sasha was ever a kid.
She was always old.
Yeah.
Is that what it is? Absolutely. I think I was a good child, but I had sort of almost I would go from like being the sort of the best student to worst student in my class, like 3 times in 12 years. I don't understand what that had to do with it, and you know, caused my friends all kinds of problems, and then recover next year somehow. And that's in my memory, that's the best that I can remember as a sort of. Now looking back at it, I have no idea what it was.
So, Johanna, are you still bossy to this day?
Yes, yeah.
I think I like when I have a strong opinion, I'm not afraid to express it. Guess what I'm trying to get at is that I think I'm attuned to what people, let's say our group in the office, I really want to get to know them as people, and I want to sort of know what they want. And I have this image of myself that I'm very friendly and very approachable, but then that's not what I'm hearing from my students or what I'm hearing sometimes from staff. And I hear I'm intimidating or that I tend to be curt with people. And it's not, no, that has any, it's not intentional, certainly. And it just, I think I'm very direct and it's cultural. And I want to get to the bottom of the issue sooner rather than later. I don't like beating around the bush. And that hasn't changed. Then I feel like there's a logical answer coming from whatever the situation is. And then we should just pursue that. Let's not piss around anymore. And I think that's where that sort of feeling bossiness is coming from.
You guys have what I would qualify as very, very different upbringings. Can you speak a little bit to where you grew up? And tell us how that would have shaped you.
I have stayed put the most. I grew up in Winnipeg. I've lived here all my life. All my family is from here. They've sort of gone a little further away across Canada recently, but so fairly sort of, I would call it stable, or we could use other words like boring or settling or whatever. But I think there was a sort of inherent stability to my upbringing, a very pragmatic approach. My family would have come over from Germany and the Ukraine. I'm first generation Canadian since they came over. And so there was a sort of, you don't ask for much out of life. You live the life that's in front of you and make the most of it. And you don't need to complain. And a very direct sort of simple approach to life. And I think I tried to live that way and sort of take that on as a way of being, and I think they've given me that. I'm grateful for it, that you can find the good in any situation and focus on the opportunities rather than the things that are there to complain about. So I feel that that's what living in Winnipeg has given me, this Midwest cold, you know, unrelenting cold for 4 or 5 months of the year. We're in the middle of a ridiculous cold spell right now. And I don't know, there's just sort of a clarity to how people live here. It's simple, but it's not dull. And I think that's what this place has given me. Again, Sasha had no childhood, so he has no upbringing
exactly,
to speak of.
So can you speak to the no childhood idea?
I had, you know, the happiest of childhoods ever. Yeah, I don't know that there was anything other than there was an expectation to do well. I don't think there was anything other that defined my childhood. Like it was, I think, perfectly normal, supportive, great family, great parents. And so there's not much to dig into it. When the war started, I wasn't a child anymore, I guess, so that doesn't make it any more interesting.
Would it be okay for you to speak a little bit to the war and how that shaped your later life?
Yeah, sorry, I could. I think the biggest impact that it had was actually coming to Canada, because I don't know whether I would ever uproot and relocate if the war wasn't the if the war didn't happen. I do think there's something the three of us had while, and maybe that's the reason why you're asking the question. I think three of us had grown up in three, I'm gonna say, vastly different environments. Anything from communism to you know, Mennonite version of capitalism, whatever that is, in Canada. Yeah, via Finnish socialism and sort of Scandinavian socialism. So I find that to be sort of a mix. You know, you don't think about it on a day to day, but I think it's actually very curious of people and personalities and the you know, what do I bring to this relationship. So the most important thing is that it got me uprooted and got me to Canada. I often live in denial. I've been accused of that before. So when I look back on any past, even if it's very stressful and traumatic as war might have been, I do look at it and remember all the good days, really, rather than the bad days. Sometimes when the going gets hard, I go back in my memories to say, well, I could have been dead. So, you know, whatever's happening right now in Canada is not that bad. But I do not really think about it much. It did two things. It did sort of make an impact on my education, because it was just happening as I entered university, so I had to put that on hold for a little while. And but I think it only forced me to work harder later to catch up. So that was sort of the results from it. Looking back at it now, I've sort of blindly just pursued education and whatever I could, coming from that happenstance. And I do think that made me a much harder worker than I would be otherwise. And it made me grow up in a way that I would just go and fight what I think is worth fighting for.
When you fled, what made you come to Canada? Was there any particular reason?
The only country that would take immigrants without prejudice, I guess, refugees without condition. Every other country had conditions that were actually insurmountable for most people. So, you know, it was rather a vote, not a vote of confidence, but a sign of confidence that the country would be looking at immigration in a way Canada did at the time. So it felt like for a brief moment there during our last conservative government, as the numbers of immigrants were dropping due to political climate in Canada, I felt that that's not a Canada I wanted to live in. But when I came here, coming here was a perfect, if I had to immigrate anywhere, I would recommend that to everybody. I had that experience to everybody. It was just a perfect experience, the way we're taken care of and so on.
Joanna, you want to add something to that?
Sure. I think I was shaped by a couple of things if I tried to boil it down. One would be sort of the sandbox in the between the apartment buildings where I grew up, and that was the place where you would kind of negotiate your territory and forge friendships and lifelong relationships with other people. The other thing would have been that I had very strong grandmothers who kind of, now that I think back on it, they've just recently passed away at the tender age of 95 or somewhere in that region. It's some sort of internal built-in confidence that comes from deep within those roots, I think, that's always been present. And then my parents both work full-time and mom often overtime. And so I had this place or a caretaker that I would go to, and she had five other kids there, and they were all boys, so it was only girls, sort of. And I always think about that, sort of like fessed up and being the youngest one at the same time. And so, I don't know, there's something familiar with the situation that I guess architecture puts you in, that fight for your spot.
You just spoke of your strong grandmothers, and that's the perfect segue into talking about mentors. Do you guys have any mentors, and what do you get out of this kind of relationship?
I'm their mentor.
Oh, no, yeah.
At my age, I'm their mentor. I consider myself to be a mentor. Take it back now, guys.
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I have mentors that I think are outside of, like, maybe those relationships haven't been formalized to be that, but they're generally outside of the field of architecture, I would say. I have a very interesting upstairs neighbor that I'm always at awe at what she's doing and sort of wonder Like, she doesn't stop anywhere. She's sort of like conquering the world day to day, and it's really inspiring. Yeah, and then those sort of childhood mentorships that occur sort of without any formal arrangement, I think, are a big part of who one becomes later on in life.
Mentors. I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that. But the easy answer is, I think my father passed away 20 years ago, and I was just sort of embarking on this architecture journey or career or whatever passion you want to call it. And but I do often think back to the things that he would have put into my life. And I was just thinking, as we were thinking about childhood, that we grew up just outside of the city here, and we had the largest sort of play structure in our backyard. One day, my dad said, it was after a storm, and he said, "Guys, all these telephone poles have been blown over and we're allowed to take them." And I'm like, "So what? Like, why would you take them? Like, what's the point of that?" So we went and collected all of these enormous telephone poles and erected this enormous play structure in our backyard. Like, we had monkey bars, or whatever you want to call them, these bars to climb on that if you fell off, you would risk breaking your leg, or like, it was just the most ridiculous thing. But it speaks to sort of a moment of like, but it caused sort of joy or happiness or hilarity or whatever you want to call it for us as kids, and for him, it gave him joy to do this thing that nobody would have thought of. And I take that as an example to live by. He worked hard. He was the hardest working person I've met, and all the of courses sort of life, like provide for family, do all these things, but make sure there's some moments of unexpectedness and spontaneity and just sort of pure emotion. Don't be afraid of it. So anyway, that's I would put him down as a mentor for the early part of my life. And there's things there that I try to.
Let's reverse that equation a little bit and talk about how you guys work within your office. Johanna, you talked very briefly early on about how you're trying to approach the way you work within your office and you interact with your employees. Can you guys speak to the culture of the office? And is there anything that you would consider unique about it?
We're trying to create an atmosphere where people are free to express their opinion about anything and everything at any given time. And it was supposed to be as level as possible, in a sense. And I can appreciate that, you know, things don't always work out in practice, that you still sometimes have to make a call on a project. But if we're trying to set it up in a way that in any given project, that if there's a great idea, if there's a good idea, it can come from anywhere, including the accountant. That's sort of the general approach to process in the office. But I'm not sure that it's terribly unique. I mean, you talk about these sort of things, you know, it's pretty common.
Would that be something you're consciously trying to build up?
Yes, I think so. I mean, for sure, it was that from the get-go, and it was easier to make it work in practice when there wasn't a generation gap. Now we're starting to feel that there's a gap and oftentimes it's harder to get the younger crew members to speak up or express their ideas as freely as probably some of the people who've been around the block can and have the technical expertise and so forth behind them. And I think our issue is that the more familiar we are with each other and working with each other, the more shorthand the patient often is about design. So when someone new comes into that equation, it's harder to integrate them. So those are the challenges that we face, but we certainly try to make an effort that when you have a project team together, that, you know, they're all part of the initial discussions about concept, doesn't matter how the work gets divvied up later on.
I think maybe something that just came to mind is no shortcuts to design is something, is part of the culture that I think we're trying to live up to, instill here. And we constantly remind ourselves of that. I think just that this sort of effort and work and effort, I think, is the best word to describe it, that it has to go into every project and into every idea and into every collaboration as a culture, that there's no shortcuts to this.
So I'd like to switch gears again a little bit and talk about creativity. What's the place of creativity in your lives and how important is it?
a tough question, because I guess our lives to work are pretty much defined by that. But when we go, well, that's the pursuit, yeah. Right? Defining room for it. So I think it's the real pursuit. You know, we once early on in our practice, when we had, I think, been in business maybe 3 years, we looked at the what the day goes into, and, you know, how you envision when you're a young architect out of school, you think, like, you know, when you go on your own, you're going to devote this massive amount of time into that creative. And then we looked at the sort of our daily task and realized that maybe 10% of it goes into creative pursuits. Other stuff is putting out fires, it's managing office or whatever else, pursuing new work, things like that, that weren't necessarily falling under the definition of creative. I know my two partners here are big chefs. I reap the benefits of that, so that's a creative problem. I used to have time, as I said, for creating my own outfits and things like that. That's fallen off the radar recently. So it's not, it just doesn't seem to be time to pause for the creative pursuit to the extent that we would like outside of work. I think it's the honest truth. I call you Manu, I've had something with the kids that we still do.
Yeah, I get to figure out new and creative ways to discipline them. I don't know, creativity, we're all creative people. So it sort of, it wraps it, like we're wrapped in it, I think, all the time. I mean, there's days where you know you haven't been able to express it enough. But I don't know, I think it's hard to even separate it from anything in life. And I think that's part of the office too. We try, like, even the most mundane and simple tasks have to be looked at consistently and rigorously to make sure that everything possible has been uncovered in those situations. I think that's all of us. It's just sort of in part of us and part of most people in the office, that they look at the life through a creative lens.
I don't think we think about being creative.
No.
Well, I sort of find us going through the cycle constantly of between creativity, intelligence, and intuition, and the and somehow it's hard to wear all three hats at the same time. But that's sort of our process. To a certain extent, get defined by cycling through, you know, through the feeling, through letting creative thought take over, and through intelligence, letting intuition sort of counterbalance your guide, counterbalance pragmatism, you know, through intelligence and so on. And so I find to me, that's one of the most interesting aspects of architecture is the opportunity to exercise all three simultaneously at all times. So I don't find creativity to be the most essential of the aspects of design, but part that without which good architecture or good design cannot exist. However, on its own, it is futile or shallow or empty. And so I would suggest that, you know, creative process, if you wish, is not all about creativity. It's about all the other things, including intuition and intelligence. And that's what we try to practice. And it probably takes a lifetime to master it or to get as far as, I guess, as you what it's ever going to get. To me, that's what is really exciting, because in any given day, you're constantly cycling not only through those aspects through one project but through multiple projects, and the sort of constantly are firing on different cylinders in your brain, and that you know, in your heart and in your brain, and that's what makes it so bloody exciting.
Following up on the idea of creativity, can you guys speak to things that inspire you in life? People, objects, art, whatever.
Well, I was going to say people, but people in the sense of their relationships, what makes people tick. I'm always interested in sort of digging under the surface a little bit, and whatever the situation, whether it's a situation that arises from our practice or whether it's external to that. To me, as soon as I meet someone new or I encounter them in a business relationship or so on, like, I have yearning to try to figure out what sort of makes the world go round for them. And then oftentimes those things are inspiring, because you just realize how sort of complex and multifaceted people can be. And they sort of, in my world anyway, at the core of everything, human relationships and human ambitions and pursuits. And sometimes they're ridiculous and sometimes admirable and sometimes they're noble and sometimes I don't know what. But there just needs to be, like, it seems like it's an the renewable resource, is that there's always something new to be discovered.
And yet the world would be so much simpler without people.
I don't know. And then the other day I was inspired by the elf. Like, I just find the whole sort of infrastructure in cities to be sometimes just extraordinary, and I don't know how it all got there. And some really smart people put all that together and figure out how things work. But it's sort of the systems that work together and the way people move about in cities or go about their daily lives, and the framework that supports that dynamic is just awe-inspiring at times. So
yeah, for me, it's intelligence, actually. Like, when I can get evidence, and whether it's through, as you say, you know, an engineer figuring out a complex problem. But to me, that's sort of one of the things that inspires me tremendously to try harder. Maybe that just speaks to the lack of heart.
Well, then that's depressing, because I had the same word. I was thinking, what actually inspires me? And it's,
yes, I'm so happy that I pulled it off.
Really, really smart things like are inspiring. People who actually look at a problem and find an intelligent way through it, not just our way.
Yeah, exactly. And on the flip side, things that are people, if you wish, that can't just find a way out of it or figure something out. That's something that really annoys the hell out of me. Because maybe that goes back, I don't know, to your question about designer creativity. As a designer, you're really thinking about everything and ways to be able to do it better, or in a new way that would maybe expose something that we did not know about a phenomenon or a thing or a person or a collective and so on. So so I think that's one of the reasons, both, at least I am attracted to intelligence, which is, I hate to use the word problem solving, but it's sort of just thinking and using your brain, which is basically nothing but energy, and then coming up with things that are material value.
There's a grit above the city. It brings me back in sort of history, and it's like identity of the place, and it's all of those awesome things that for some reason is embedded in it, and just because I've been on it lots lately.
You know what I find smartest about it, and there's not enough in the world of examples of that, is the platforms that are in between the two tracks. And I find that to be so, like, there are a couple of them that are on the side, a couple of older ones, and somebody somewhere figured out to put a platform between the two tracks, and therefore, you know, cut in half the amount of circulation and improve the way one rides L.
I think a good segue to inspiration is talking about risk. What would be the biggest risk you guys have ever taken?
Oh, that's easy. Not to take one. We get asked that question quite often, sometimes project related, sometimes generally, as you're saying. And every time the answer has been, if we haven't taken that risk, we wouldn't be where we are today. And so therefore, the biggest risk we could have taken is not taking it. To me, that, I'm not sure if this is a cop-out answer or not, but to me, that's the answer that encompasses it all.
So are there instances of where you haven't taken a risk and it kind of brought you back?
That's a hard one to call in. I'm looking at you. What do you think?
I don't know, but it's a good question.
Yeah, very good.
Well, I think if it relates to sometimes saying no to something because it was putting our business venture at risk and maybe giving us less opportunities, there's been some good examples of when that panned out and when it was actually good for us not to. So that, if that's called risk, I don't know. But it was good.
It's a very good question, though, I think. And like, even if we don't have an answer necessarily to it, I think it's an incredibly valid question for a practice that, like Sasha said, prides itself or has at its core, you take the risks that you feel committed to or that are required to take. It's just a really important question.
We're not terribly risk adverse. Generally, we jump in with 2 feet and try to figure it out later because everything seems like an opportunity, and that's oftentimes our downfall too, that we sort of see opportunity wherever we look, doesn't matter how crummy it might be to start with, but you think, hey, well, there's a room to make a positive improvement, so maybe we should tackle this, and that's our general approach to practice and I just life in general.
So would you say that's a function of your personalities, or is there something else at play that makes you less risk averse than maybe other practices?
I think having the other two in the mix makes me more courageous, because
yeah,
I know that there's two more brains
for sure
thinking about it at the same time.
I think that's it for sure.
It's not whimsy, or it's not like loosely chasing or reckless risk. Like, I think that's important. I don't think it has ever really felt reckless.
I can't imagine, compared to a sole practitioner, being able to sort of explore new territory when they don't feel like they have somebody who has their back all the time. And I think that is the freedom that we have working together and working with such a strong group of people, is that you feel like you can go on a limb for a while, see what's out there, and somebody will help you figure the path forward out. That's what always, you know,
always
is given us the confidence, I think.
There's a confidence and a trust and a, like, there's all sorts of safety nets, it feels like, that are built into something that maybe to someone else would look fundamentally risky. It doesn't feel that way necessarily.
So the other side of the coin when we talk about risk is failure. Can you guys speak to some of your biggest failures so far?
Sometimes we, especially I think early on, we're quite optimistic of what we can expect the build-outs to be, or what we can expect our clients to sort of tackle, or what's possible in their motivations to actually get built on site. So I think that, to me, is still something that sort of is almost painful when I look at some projects and think that, you know, they should have been done differently, or I can see the errors everywhere. And because somehow weren't able to come up with details or solutions that were robust enough to withstand the reality on the site. The other thing would be not being able to sort of know how to marry what the real sort of detail needs are when we build spaces for humans and people, and how they want to live, and so not necessarily respecting all of that and letting too much of it get away to the architectural expression sometimes. But I think those are lessons that we're constantly trying to learn and take with us and bring to the future projects. So they're good lessons. I mean, one particular instance is that we worked on a housing project for low-income families, and then not realizing, trying to challenge sort of, so the ambition was noble. We were trying to challenge the size of that, you know, housing unit should be in Canada, and they tend to be much larger, as you know, than in Europe or other parts of the world. And we were sort of making them rooms European size, and then as people were moving in, realizing that they get hand-me-downs that are from local, like they're big lazy boy size sofas and things that don't necessarily fit into these tight dimensions that we were imagining. So failures like that, or somebody sort of just crying that they can't fit in because this being the reality of the situation.
But there's, like, and this isn't supposed to be a cop-out answer, but because we're also not going to be shy about them. Like, if you're not going to be shy about risks, then you can't be shy about something that didn't work out to everybody's expectations. And I think something like a core value of all of us and the office is we're not going anywhere. So if something's not working, we'll show up to figure out a way, if there's a way to make it work, and to alter those, or to meet the expectations, or to go the extra mile. Like, it honestly is not a cop-out answer. It's just how we approach it. So if things don't work out often, like from little things to big things, right? But you pursue them, and you find a way through, and you make it work because collectively you believe in where it's heading. And I think that's right. Been our clients come along for that, and our contractors and our the group that work here, like, we all are on board for that pursuit.
And the one thing we can promise you, even if things don't always work out, is that we care immensely about the outcome. And we'll do whatever we can necessary to bring it through to the other side. So that's a guarantee. Whether, you know, there's risk associated in taking the risk, of course there is. And sometimes it requires more work and effort and years of care afterwards.
That was a great conversation about failures and its lessons. I have three more questions for you, and the first of which is, what would be the accomplishment you're the most proud of so far?
We never talk about this, Johanna, but I think one of the accomplishments that we could or should recognize is the fact that we accomplished what we set out to do, despite all the odds, whether that be conservatism that we were facing or other things, but that comes sort of with the one proviso that always makes me think we're not shooting high enough. And the one of the things we've always wanted to do is measure ourselves or see how we would fare in the in the world of architecture rather than Winnipeg of architects, and the which is one of the reasons we are trying to compare ourselves, whether it is through entering different competitions or through all the other engagements that seem to come our way, including this conversation and podcast. And the
I can sort of easily speak to things that I think are your accomplishments, but then when I try to turn that around, it's much harder to sort of dissect or say anything to you. The one thing that I'm really proud of is that I think we've broadened the realm in which we get to have a say in, or we get asked to take part in issues or citywide things that go well beyond architecture. So the fact that we're sort of operating in not just, you know, the 1%, you know, providing architecture for the 1% or operating only in the confines of our own field, I think that feels like an accomplishment. It feels like we're doing something of value that way.
And so, speaking of accomplishments, but in the future, I'd like to do a little visioning exercise and picture yourselves on your deathbed, hopefully many, many years from now. What would you like your legacy to be at that point?
To me, it's just no regret. And I think it's worth for Johanna, or it's valid for Johanna as well. I think that's how I live. We make a lot of decisions, hundreds or thousands of decisions, all of us do. And when we are in a business like we are, we also have to make multiple decisions. And this is a conversation about architecture. That might be relevant, but the not having any regrets on the deathbed, I think, is the way I live. And then I guess that's maybe not an answer, because it gives you sort of, again, it's self-referential. So but that's all I've got, Johanna.
Like, it seems like you have to, like, it just sounds like a cliche answer, but I mean, you have to also be able to say that if that happened today, if you were in your deathbed today, would you have those regrets? And I think the answer for happy life has to be no. Like, if you're sort of pursuing the things that make you happy day to day, whether it's as an architect or whether it's as a person or whether it's with your family or whatever it may be, and you're creating something good in the world, then that's got to be it. And of course, we have ambitions that go well beyond that. You know, we don't dare to even say out loud, but yeah, whether achieve them or not, like the day-to-day is the more important thing.
So the last question is a little more lighthearted. Stones or Beatles?
Beatles.
Oh. Yeah. You knew that, Johanna, didn't you?
I did. But you know, the Beatles, how, like, the history of how long they practiced together, how they were such a team. And I know you're probably saying Stones because they would be more off the sort of popular track and would be more dark or whatever and troubled.
Sorry, so to make everything very difficult, I don't know, I apologize for that. Stones generally, but there are some Beatles that are way better than everything else. I'm going elsewhere, but that's far less, far more obvious. But the yes, that's sort of, that's now into music.
Yeah, Sasha would hate to be obvious.
There's no right or wrong answer. I've had people respond like a completely different band, that it was a real pleasure to have all three of you on the show. I think it was a great interview, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, Arno.
Hey again, Arno here. If you liked this interview, be sure to give us a review on SoundCloud or iTunes. This episode was produced by Revelator Studio with music by Bounce Trio. To be notified of upcoming episodes, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Revelator_TO, or sign up for our newsletter on our website at rvltr.studio. Keep on supporting creativity and never stop kicking fear in the nuts. Till next time, ciao.